Dubbed deliciously rude and darkly funny, chick lit author Kathy Lett has a new book out, which reeks revenge. The Revenge Club features four best friends approaching their 60s, feeling invisible and bent on vengeance. It continues the Australian-British writer's observations of the best and worst bits of being a woman, with female friendships definitely one of the perks. Kathy Lett has written over 15 best-selling novels and has been recognised for her advocacy of equality, human rights, physical and mental health. I asked Kathy, with the new book, what did she want to achieve?
Well, I was just so fed up with ageist sexism that women endure. You know, let's look at the sexism is sewn into our vernacular. A man my age is a silver fox, whereas I'm an old bag, a hag, a crone. You know, people are constantly judging me if I wear a short skirt or I show my bare arms. And I've never once heard a man dismissed as mutton dressed as ram. Never. And with them, all my women friends, they were hitting the menopause and they were finding themselves being overlooked at work, overlooked at home, made to feel invisible. And I think society does hand women my age the cloak of invisibility. But the question is, are we going to use that cloak for good or for evil? And I'm thinking evil. And it's not just my imagination that women my age are overlooked. MI5 a couple of weeks ago announced that they wanted to recruit middle-aged women as spies because nobody sees us. So it's a big issue. And, you know, my boomer generation have done a lot to take the stigma out of menopause, because I remember my mother's generation used to sort of be in a cardiganed coven in the corner of the kitchen whispering about the change, you know, as though Voldemort was coming. And we've done a lot to talk about that and say, look, it's a natural part of of a woman's life. Let's talk about it. But the next big hurdle for women is this ageist sexism. And, you know, just look at our TV screens. 85% of people on Australian, British, and I don't know, but I imagine it's the same in New Zealand, TV screens over 50 are men. Women just get put out to career pasture. So I want to say to women, you know, post-menopause is actually the best time of your life. Go forth and be fabulous and have a sensational second act, because you bloody well deserve it. So that's really my message, and that's the message of the book.
So the four main characters, Matilda, Cressida, Penny and Joe, just give us the setup, because it's a lovely setup.
It is a good setup. I was so pleased when I thought of it. It's basically these four women who are at university together at Oxford. And my lead character is Australian, Matilda. She's a writer. I mean, didn't have to dig deep for that one.
Well, I was going to ask you how much of you is in Matilda, because she's got red hair. She's a writer of a certain age. You know, people say that you write what you know.
Well, I'll give you the setup of the book first, then I'll explain what happened to me. So these four women, they had a bust up at uni. We don't know why in the beginning of the novel, but one of them's coming back from LA, where she's been working in special effects in the movies. And she writes them and says, look, let's get together and catch up. And the three women, other women arrive a little bit trepidatious, you know, because they haven't seen each other for so long. But just like women do, they pick up where they left off, laughing, cackling like kookaburras. It's all great. Then this man comes and sits at their table. And the women are like, I'm sorry, you can't sit there. We're waiting for a friend. And this guy says, yes, I know you're waiting for Joe Logan. And they go, how do you know that? And he says, well, I'm Joe. And they think, oh, my God, has he transitioned? What's going on? Then Joe explains that she got the sack from her company in Hollywood for the crime of being a menopausal hot mess. So just as a hoax, she went home, changed herself into a man with using her special effects techniques, went back to the same company, not only got a job, but got a pay rise and a promotion. And she thought, you know what? In a man's world, it's just so much better to be a man. And the other women are like, you're wrong. There's never been a better time to be a woman, etc. And then that week, something catastrophic happens to the other three in their careers. And that's when they re-get together for a cocktail the following week. They're like, you're so right. And that's when they decide to take revenge. But, of course, they've got a secret weapon, because Joe can now get into the men's room. So it's a delicious setup. And the reason I was burning up to write this book was that something similar happened to me. I mean, I've written, this is my 20th novel, so I've written 19 books published in 18 languages around the world. I've had a big career. And when I told my agent my idea for my new book, he's like, nobody wants to publish books about middle-aged women. They're just not that sexy. And then my publisher dropped me. And I thought, God, maybe I have passed my amuse-by date. And then I thought, wait a minute, I've never been that wrong before with my instincts about what women want to read about. So I just got a gay agent who sold the book, got me a two-book deal that day. He totally got it. And so then I could have my revenge by writing this novel and sending it straight up the bestseller charts with a character based on me and what happened to me. So listen, revenge is not only sweet, but it's totally non-fattening. So I think that's why we women are drawn to it. It's delicious.
In all seriousness, though, did you have a bit of a crisis of confidence when, you know, after all this time, after all these novels, you were dropped by your publisher?
Yes. And that was the message I was given, that middle-aged women are just not that sexy. And then I looked around and, you know, a lot of books that star a woman my age, if there's a female protagonist my age, she's lonely and miserable, and she sort of moves into her flat and wilts away and dies of despair and then gets eaten by her cats. You know, no jogger can, you know, traipse through a woodland without stubbing their toe on the body of some victim who was a woman who was naggy or needed her comeuppance. And I kept thinking, look, I don't know any women like that. All my female friends are swinging off a chandelier with a toy boy between their teeth. They're traveling the world with their girlfriends. They are having this sensational second act, a lot due to thanks to HRT, which is such a rocket fuel.
Isn't it so just? HRT is something else.
Well, I wrote a book called HRT, Husband Replacement Therapy. So, yes, I have explored that issue before. But I just think women my age are so interesting. They've got such a great hinterland. You know, we've had the heartbreaks and the love affairs and the promotions and the breakdowns, and we've raised the teenagers, and we've just got so much to say and talk about. So, you know, I'm going to continue writing novels that star funny, feisty, fabulous females having this brilliant second act, because I think for women, life is in two acts, and the trick is surviving the interval, which is the menopause, which is awful. You know, you sweat more than Donald Trump doing a Sudoku. But after that, it is so liberating. I mean, just think about it. No period cramps, no pregnancy fears. You've got all that tampon money to spend. And I think the other nice thing that happens is that you get more confident. You know, your estrogen, which is your caring, sharing hormone, drops down a little bit, and you get a bit more testosterone, and you can sort of put yourself first for the first time in your life. And it is so liberating. So there's a lot to look forward to that no one ever talks about. But, you know, I really think it's a sensational time in a woman's life. If you seize the day, you've got to carpe diem like there's no tomorrow.
What do you think go on. No, on you go.
No, I'm such a motor mouth. I'm sorry, my lips are losing weight. You know, talking, I'm doing. I'm sorry about that. They don't call me the mouth from the south or nothing. The other thing I wanted to say about the book is that it's a celebration of the sisterhood, because I'm a passionate feminist. All my books have championed women for many reasons. You know, I think, first of all, it's still a man's world. We're still getting concussion, hitting our head on the glass ceiling, and we're supposed to clean it while we're up there. We face a second glass ceiling at home, because I think even though women make up 50% of the workforce, we're still doing, what do you reckon, like 99% of all the housework and all the childcare. And even God is a bloke. I mean, you think of all the things women go through, from when you first get taken hostage by your hormones as a teenager, you know, and you're having periods once a month, then there's pregnancy where everything swells to sumo wrestler proportions, then there's childbirth where you stretch your birth canal the customary, 5 kilometres? Then there's mastitis, then there's the menopause, and then just when everything goes quiet, do you know what happens? You grow a beard. How can that be fair? I could make like a macrame hanging basket arrangement that's going on here. But the one thing we do have is this sisterly solidarity. I mean, my other motto is laugh and the world laughs with you, cry and you get salt in your shampers, which we definitely don't want. But having that wonderful sisterhood, I think women, I always say this, that women are each other's human wonder bras, uplifting, supportive, and making each other look bigger and better. And I would be totally flat without my female friends. So we're very lucky we've got that our cups can runneth over with love for each other.
Why do you think that we still have this this trope of, the sad postmenopausal woman being eaten by her cats in her flat?
I think it plays into the stereotype that men like. They think if we're no longer fecund, we're off their radar completely. So we're sort of surplus to requirements. And in evolutionary terms, the menopause is a new phenomenon because, until a few centuries ago, we were all dead at like 32 or something. So it is something that we're getting used to as a society, this new phenomenon. And also, it's still a man's world. We women suffer from what I call facial prejudice. We get judged on our looks in a way that men don't. So as when they think we're no longer attractive because we've got a few wrinkles and crinkles, as I said, they put us out to pasture. And I do think it's aging. It is difficult for women. I know aging to women's like kryptonite to Superman. Show me a woman who's happy with her age, and I'll show you the electroconvulsive therapy scorch marks. But I do say to women, d try not to d go down the cosmetic surgery route. I just think that's just why play into that stereotype. A lot of my women friends are being traded in for younger models, and they'll do anything they can to stay young. Like I won't see them for a while, and then I'll see these breasts coming down the high street. They've kind of got their own postcode, and then the lips, they've got that weird lip look where they've taken the fat out of their bottoms and injected into their lips, so they're literally talking out of their backsides, which explains a lot about Hollywood.
Yeah,
But
I read a thing recently about how women, as they get older, you kind of have to make the choice between looking older or looking weird. Do you think that's still the choice?
totally. And I say to these women, why are you doing this to yourselves? And they're like, well, I want to attract a new man. I'm going, but why would you want a man who only wants you because you're silicon from tonsils to toenail? You wouldn't want a man like that. Men have to learn to read between our lines, and our facial lines. It's all there, the books, the babies, the hours of fun-loving flirtation. Why would you want to have a p complete personalityectomy and take away your character? So, but we just have to, more women just have to try to eschew that particular. That particular way of trying to stay, because it's so demoralizing. Yeah, and I think just be witty. Witty is better than pretty. If you can if you can lob out a fabulous one-liner, you're going to get more attention than if you've put your bottom fat into your lips.
Something else that we're talking about on the program today is the phenomenon, and the rising kind of phenomenon of trad wives. Is this something you've come across? Women who, like younger women who are, very much into homemaking and letting their husband, take the lead and have the career while they, look after the home and the children. What do you make of that?
Well, these poor women have been lobotomized. I mean, any woman who says she gets high on housework has inhaled way too many cleaning products. Emily Pankhurst and co tied themselves to the railings to get us out of the kitchen. My only recipe, my favorite recipe, is domestic goddess roasted slowly on a spit. So, I mean, I think I've got a younger man now, and what's great about him? Well, he adores me, doesn't bore me, does all my chores for me, but he also loves to cook, and it's just so liberating. And women have been tethered to the kitchen, mums, by our heart and our apron strings for so long. And the joy of cutting that, and getting out and conquering the world. And that's why it's interesting to point out that the majority of divorces now in New Zealand, Britain, and Australia are initiated by women, and the peak time is when the husband retires. And it's because we want different things. Men, when they retire, because their testosterone goes down and their estrogen comes up a bit, they want to stay at home and nest. And women are like, I've nested. I've buttered 4 million acres of toast. I've roasted 4,000 flocks of chickens. I want to go up Everest and down the Amazon. And I think unless men pull up their psychological socks, they're going to find themselves being put out with the recycling, which is a shame because marriage suits men much more than it suits women. You've probably read all these statistics that married women, sorry, married men live longer than single men, have less heart disease or mental problems, whereas single women live longer than married women, have less heart disease and mental problems. So, men need to keep up without the changes happening to us if they want to stay happy and and married. But to the trad wife thing is just, I think, just truly, truly tragic. I mean, yes, I think I'd also like to say to men, it's not as though women are asking for a lot. We'd like equal pay, that would be great. We'd like them to work out that mutual orgasm isn't an insurance company. That would be great too. And we'd like them to help more around the house, which is actually in their interest, as it's scientifically proven that no woman ever shot her husband while he was vacuuming. And we'd like them to do the odd sensitive things with, snow peas in the kitchen, because the way to a woman's heart is through her stomach. That is not aiming too high. What does a woman really want in bed? Breakfast
Breakfast.
and a really good book, I would say. So yeah, I mean, I think that trad wife thing is probably getting much more media attention than it actually deserves, because I don't know any women like that. Do you?
I don't. But I guess you just because you don't know someone doesn't mean that it's not out there, and it does seem to be out there, and it's people all over social media, and I guess that then also influences what other people see and think and feel. Not just people their own age, but also younger people. And but I'm interested in marriage, because you left your marriage after, what, about a quarter of a century?
28 years. Yes, that's right. I don't think that divorce is a failure. It's just a change. And because of our longevity, because we're living for so long now, from honeymoon to tomb can be 60, 70 years. It's a long time to find each other's anecdotes interesting. And, if you've found your love match for life, where you have won life's lottery, but if your marriage is going stale and you're no longer finding joy in each other, there is no shame, no stigma in moving on. But I think you must try and stay friends. I've been married twice, and I'm very good friends with both my ex-husbands, because you've got to remember there's still love there. There's something about that person you loved, and you've got to concentrate, work hard to keep that little flame alive
And
and
you had a
respect.
real bolt of lightning for your second husband, certainly.
Well, initially I was married to Kim Williams, who's now the chair of the ABC in Australia, which it couldn't be better. He'll be brilliant at fighting for the ABC and steering them through sort of choppy waters. And yes, I did have a, they call it in French, I can't speak French, but it's some, I think it's pronounced a coup de foudre.
That
Does
sounds
that
good.
sound, it's a French for a bolt of lightning. And I went on, my ex-second husband, Geoffrey Robertson, did a show in Australia called The Hypotheticals, which is like an intellectual aerobics class. And I sat in on that show for Kylie Minogue, who couldn't turn up. And I just fell in love with Jeff. It's ridiculous, because we've actually got a video of our first meeting, and my eyelash batting average would rival like Alan Border or something. I'm batting away. But of course, Jeff said, well, first of all, let me tell you, when I met Jeff, he was going out with Nigella Lawson. I mean, he broke up with her for me, and I can't cook, as I told you. I used my smoke alarm as a timer. So I think he really regretted it in years to come.
That's not
But
why you said you like domestic goddess spit roasted, is it?
I've told her that as well. We are friends now. But the thing about Jeffrey is, I think what women like about men is their intellect. And that's the only place size does count, that big throbbing organ between the ears. And I mean, Jeffrey's just, he's so erudite. I think erudite's some kind of glue, but he really is so clever. But he always used to say to me that if only we're very good, I'm very good friends with Kylie Minogue, who's divine.
You
And
name
when she'd
drop
come
her.
over, oh my God, I'm going for gold in the name drop with Olympic. But the point I wanted to make is, because I sat in for her on that show, when she would come for dinner in London, Jeff would say, oh, if you hadn't come that night, Kathy, and Kylie had come, I'd now be Mr. Minogue. And I'd be like, oh, in your wet dreams, Robbo, as if.
But leaving your
So, yes,
marriage
that's.
and embarking on swinging from the chandelier with a toy boy between your teeth.
Yeah.
You were in a body, or are you were in a body that was 28 years older, and I'm interested in that relationship and how you navigated that.
I know what you're saying. You want to know, did I hold my stomach in bed for the
Yeah,
first time?
well, you
Was
know, it's just,
yeah,
you're
I
turning
know.
up as a different person, you know?
Yes, it's true. But my boyfriend now, I met him when he was, it's a very, what they call in the movies, a cute meet or a meet cute. And I was jogging through the park, Regent's Park in London, and he was playing Bach in the park. He's a classical guitarist. So it, and I just thought that music was so beautiful. And I stopped and went over and talked to him. And then I thought, wow, he's Irish. So who doesn't want to listen to that accent? I just can't stop talking to you. And I was worried about that. I mean, I hadn't been with another man for 28 years. And that thought about, wrinkles and crinkles and what's dropped and what's drooped and whether I had to hold my stomach in, I was worried. But to be honest, in the heat of passion, none of that matters. And also, dimmer switch, greatest sex aid known to womankind. Just keep the lights down low. That's my top tip for you.
Tell me a little bit about your son Jules, because it comes up a lot in the book, autism, because Maddie, the daughter of Matilda, is autistic
Yes.
and is kind of, in some ways, one of the superheroes of the book.
Yeah.
When did you figure out about your son having autism, and what was it like keeping your head above water?
Oh gosh, it was really hard. And for any mother, any parent, any grandparent listening who has a child on the autistic spectrum, my heart goes out to you. You all deserve mothering and grandmothering and grandparenting medals because it's really hard. But back then, autism was a diagnosis that just dragged you down into the dark. And suddenly my son, he was 3 when he got the diagnosis, had become a plant in a gloomy room. And it was my job to kind of drag him into the light. And I think you go through different phases. The first stage I went through was denial. I bankrupted myself seeing every medical expert in the country. I hate to think how many doctors' children I've now put through university. And then you go through a stage of just feeling sorry for yourself, where you probably drink way too much Chardonnay. And then finally, you just sort of start to accept that this is the unique little person you've been given, and you've just got to do your best by them. And the thing about autism, people on the spectrum have a literal, lateral, tangential logic, which is truly original and fascinating. But sadly, too often they end up living in a bedsit on benefits because we as a society just don't think outside the neurotypical box. But we know with diagnostic hindsight that Mozart and Einstein and Orwell and Van Gogh and Steve Jobs and all these amazing artists and mathematicians, etc., were on the spectrum. So I don't like labels. I think a label's something on the side of a jam jar, and normal is just a setting on a washing machine. And the only reason we use a label to help is like a psychological signpost to get the right help. But when I write about autism in my books, I always try and put a positive spin on it because they are the most extraordinary people. And also they can be very, very funny because autistic people have no filter. So I'll just give you one example. When my son was about 13, I took him to Downing Street to a charity do. And I introduced him to the then Prime Minister, Tony Blair. I said, "Oh, Jules, this is the Prime Minister, Tony Blair." And Jules says, "Oh, yes, you're the one my mother calls Tony, blah, blah, blah." And I'm going, I couldn't think of anything to say. And he's always doing that kind of thing to me. So when I write about autism, I try and be positive because they do have so many super, superpowers. Like in the book, it's also a great technique. It's a great shortcut for me to use as an autistic character because we know they're good at computer skills and they can hack into things. So it saves you a lot of exposition that they can just do that. But I also try and show the funny, quirky, endearing side because I so want to take the stigma out of autism.
Do you think it's is it useful to always think of autism as being a superpower?
Yes, I mean, look, it's a spectrum, and some people call it an extreme form of maleness. And I do think there's a lot of men out there walking around undiagnosed. I mean, even if they're computer engineers or if they're scientifically inclined, or mathematical geniuses, there's a chance they're also a little bit on the spectrum. And I remember even with my own darling dad, who sadly passed away 10 years ago, he was a He was an electrical engineer. And I remember once my mum and dad had a really bad fight, and they were deeply in love. They had a beautiful marriage, but this one fight they had, and mum was serving his meals in silence and turning her back to him in bed. And I've got three gorgeous sisters, and we were all so upset, and we were walking around the house on eggshells, and it was just awful. And then after a week, mum said to my dad's name was Mervin. He worked in optic fibre. We called him Optic Merv. Mum said to dad, "Oh, darling, darling, oh, Mervy, Mervy, I just can't bear it. We've just got to make up." He just looked at her and said, "What?" He hadn't noticed. And I don't think that's so unusual with a lot of men. I'm sure a lot of women who are listening now are thinking, "Wait a minute, is my husband on the spectrum?" So there is a lot more of it about than we realize. But yes, in some ways, it is a superpower. My son, for example, knows every match point of any tennis game ever played. He knows it, when he meets a movie star, like if he meets a movie star through me somewhere, he'll tell them every single movie they've been in, even the voiceovers and the ads they have done, and yet can't get the right change from the corner store. There's a big dichotomy in their IQ. But as I said, they could give back to society in the most wonderful ways if we just give them a chance to shine.
You're listening to Saturday Morning on RNZ National. I'm talking with Kathy Lett. Her latest book is The Revenge Club. You were name dropping earlier with Kylie Minogue and Nigella Lawson, and but here's one. I read that you did you really hide Julian Assange in your attic?
Well, the upside of being married to a human rights lawyer is that you do have a lot of interesting house guests. So, I mean, I've had exiled poets, I've had, prisoners on the run, I've had banned poets taking refuge in our attic. I've had Salman Rushdie was up there. James Hewitt was there. Remember the guy who was having sex with Princess
Princess
Diana?
Diana.
Yes, he came for advice because he was the most wanted man in Britain. He arrived in the boot of someone's car. I had Julian Assange up there for quite a while. I've had everyone in my attic except Dorian Gray. And I got to know Julian very well, actually, and I was very quick to realize that he's on the autistic spectrum for sure, which is why he got into so many difficult situations socially because he just wasn't reading the room. And I got to know him so well, actually, that when The Simpsons were doing their 500th episode, they asked me to write his scene, which was a great, what a great thing to have on your CV, writing for The Simpsons, which is such a brilliant show. And I wrote a scene where my favorite scene was where he's on the run with Marge and Homer, and Julian is doing a barbecue, and Marge is just loving the marinade he's using. And she's like, "Oh, Julian, can you please give me the recipe?" To which he replies, "Well, I'd like to, but I never reveal my sources." Ha ha, come on, wasn't bad at short notice. Come on, have a little laugh. So yeah, and I'm desperately sad for him now. What he's going through is just inhumane, such torture. I mean, he didn't steal anything. He published, as did the New York Times, as did the Guardian, as did the Australian and the New Zealand papers. So it is outrageous what's happening to him, and I'm deeply, deeply worried about his mental health. So I'm just hoping that we can get some deal and get him sent back to Australia, which, started modern life as the world's largest open prison. And we like the courage of their convictions. We're convict stock,
What about the allegations against him by women, though? Did that make you uncomfortable?
Well, yes. Well, no, because I actually read the whole transcripts, because don't forget, my husband was his lawyer, and Jen Robinson, Jeff's junior, is also his lawyer. And when you actually read the transcripts, you'll see that it was a much it wasn't a clear cut case at all. So I just think his autism got in the way, and everything was misread, and it just turned into a quagmire of misunderstanding. So yeah, and I think at the moment we just have to try and save that poor man's sanity.
Speaking of men, do you think men read your books?
Well, women tell me that they'll be lying in bed reading my book, and they'll be laughing, and their male partner will say, "Oh, what are you reading a book by that loudmouth, feminist harridan for?" And then she'll read out a bit, and he'll go, "That's not funny." Then he'll go, "Well, read me another bit." She'll read another bit, and he'll go, Okay, well, read me one more bit, and then eventually he'll disappear into the toilet with the novel, because you know how some men think sitting on the toilet is a leisure activity. So, and I think, well, if that's why I part of the reason I write funny books. First of all, I think women are really funny. When you go on a girls' night out, you have to be hospitalized from hilarity, don't you? I mean, we just well, that's a way. It's like a coping mechanism with us. That's how we. So if you can laugh at something, it's like strapping a giant shock absorber to your brain. And it's not just me imagining women are funny. Anthropologists say that women laugh more than men in all cultures on the planet, especially in all female groups. And I'm sure we're laughing about the same thing, you know, the inadequacies of the male of the species. But I think, you know, if you can disarm with charm, you've got a much better chance of getting your message across. So I think if I can make a man laugh and entertain him, he might also sort of absorb the feminist message that I'm getting across about the inequalities that women still face. So yes, I think for me it's the technique that works. And also I like to entertain my readers because the world can be a bad, sad place, especially now. There's so much doom and gloom. If I can lighten their load in any way and give them a laugh and cheer them up. And also I am an optimist. I don't think optimism is an eye disease. So you know, it's a joy for me to be able to lift my readers up in some way.
You make a small appearance, a little cameo in your own book towards the end. That Aussie chum of yours, Kathy Lett, she's a bit brash for my liking. Brash is an interesting word, isn't it? What's your
Well,
reaction to brash? Are you brash? Is that a good thing?
I probably am a bit bolshy and a bit brash, you know. And I think it came from growing up as a surfy girl. Because remember the first book I wrote, you may not have read it because you grew up in, I think, Edinburgh, didn't you?
Yeah, I grew up in
Edinburgh?
Scotland. Yeah.
In
Yeah.
Scotland. So, but in Australia and New Zealand, this first book I wrote, Puberty Blues, is a cult classic. And it's about the surfy guys we grew up with, you know, and they really disprove the theory of evolution. They were evolving into apes. And I wrote this book about that surfy culture to say to other surfy girls, you're more than just a life support system to a pair of breasts. But the surfy girls I grew up with were beautiful, you know, blonde, brown, slim, tall, blue eyes. And I'm a bonsai brunette whose bra cup do not runneth over. So I had to develop some other way of getting noticed. So I think I got good at giving quiplash. I call it the black belt in Tung Fu. So just so the boys would notice me. I mean, otherwise the Pope would be ringing me up for tips on celibacy. So I think I just became a little bit loud and brash just so that I'd get laid, basically. But also, on a serious note, well, women, it is a skill women have, this verbal dexterity, because we actually use more words in our daily vocabulary. We use about 350, 400 extra words than men. So, you know, and if men are physically stronger, but if a man is belittling you at work or putting you down in some way, if you can take him down with a withering one-liner and get other people to laugh at that bully, well, you've won. So I think it's a skill that women should hone. And when I go into schools and talk to girls about how they're going to cope in the world, I always say to them, you're underdressed unless you, when you're going out, you've got to tuck a couple of one-liners up your trouser legs so you can give out, you can shoot from the lip, you know, with a withering one-liner. It's a good weapon to add into our armory.
But if we've got such great vocabularies, more so than men, why are
Yeah.
people snobby about chiclet?
Well, I actually hate the term chick lit. I mean, even though
Sorry.
I kind of, I no, it's fine. I kind of invented it, you know, with Puberty Blues,
Yeah.
Girls Night Out, Father, etc. But to me, look, men who write first person funny fiction, like Nick Hornby, etc., they get compared to Chekhov, whereas we get Chikhov. We get a pink cover with a cupcake on it. So I think it is quite dismissive. But then I also kind of invented mummy lit, which is now a thing. But when I wrote Mad Cows and Fetal Attraction, and then I guess I invented nip lit when I wrote Nip and Tuck. And I thought, well, I want a new genre for us now. Now at this age, you know, I was talking about women my age who've got this fantastic hinterland, so many experiences and adventures to write about. But I thought chick lit doesn't cut it. I thought, what about chook lit, baby? But then I thought, Because you do, when you turn 50, you do become a little bit more strident. I thought, I want to have a new genre that's called I Don't Give a Shit Lit, because that's how women my age feel. We're like, if not now, when? And it is, as I said earlier, truly liberating. So that's going to be my new genre.